Hello, and welcome to Securing Sexuality, the podcast where we discuss the intersection of intimacy
and information security. I'm Wolf Gorlick.
He's a hacker. And I'm Stephanie Gorlick.
She's a sex therapist. And together we're going to discuss what safe sex looks like in a digital age. Today we're chatting with Jackie Rotman, the founder and CEO of the Center of Intimacy Justice, which recently released their research last year on the ways in which Meta has systematically blocked information about women's health. But today we're here to talk with her about their advocacy work and all the ways that they're improving this for us all. So Jackie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I love your duo for this podcast.
Oh, thanks so much.
You know, before we did the podcast, whenever we obviously we travel a lot, as do you, and whenever we were in a cab together or a taxi, that would be the same thing, or a Lyft, you know, the driver always makes conversations. They're always like, so what do you do? And the minute we said hacker and sex therapist, they would go, no, you guys are liars. Clearly you're like con people or something, because that is not a combo that shows up together. So, you know, it made for a fun concept to talk to people.
That's amazing. Wow, I want to be one of those cab rides. We'll have our online version today.
Yes.
Absolutely, we will. But tell us a bit about your advocacy work. Now, you know, I hear phrases like intimate justice. I've, of course, looked at the Intimacy Justice, the Center for Intimacy Justice website. You know, what brought you here and what are you changing?
We're a team of about 10 women on our team and a whole movement and collective of hundreds of other entrepreneurial organizations working on sexual health and wellness for women and people with vulvas. And what I started to discover in 2017, 2018, is that every time I would talk with an entrepreneur who was founding a business to support women's sexual well-being, every single one of them said that they were being blocked from Facebook and Instagram. They couldn't advertise. And this is stunting entrepreneurial innovation in sexual health and making it so people can't access information. And so we started Center for Intimacy Justice, which is an advocacy organization. We've been taking on Meta to work to change this discriminatory blocking of information about female sexuality. And we've had some really exciting successes, which I can share about, that make this a really exciting and fun movement to be a part of.
So I've got to say, I'm glad that you're doing this, because this is an issue that impacts a lot of my friends and colleagues. It impacts us. My practice Instagram has been permanently banned from advertising. And, you know, that impacts our ability to share the work that we do here. That impacts our ability to share sexual health information with my clients and people that follow us. But we were trying to figure out, like, what is the standard? What are we running afoul of? When you first published, you know, the big change with Meta that your center negotiated, I actually reached out to them. And I'm like, okay, but Center for Intimate Justice just did this. So can you explain to me where I'm violating community standards? And they refused to answer. And yet I have colleagues who have their own practices who aren't banned. And it seems really arbitrary. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what you know about how those decisions are made. Because I know that that is one of the most confusing decision or confusing pieces for people, even in just talking about this. So maybe as a level set, like how do they decide who gets banned and who doesn't?
First of all, I'm so sorry that that happened. And for a sex therapy business, which is so important in helping so many people, so I'm really sorry that you're facing that and seeing such a disparity and lack of consistency with other people in the same space. What we've seen is similarly that there's both a lack of transparency and that some companies can advertise and some can't, even when the policy should either say that all of them can or all of them can't. We've even met with people that became only allowed to advertise because their investor lived on the same street as Sheryl Sandberg, or they had an investor who used to work at Facebook early on. And so there's, or, you know, somebody in their family runs a huge ad agency. So there have been these differences based on who you know, when it really should be about, okay, is this about sexual health and wellness or reproductive health? And we did notice in early October that sometime before that, Facebook had made a lot of revisions, as you referred to their policy, saying that things like sex education were supposed to be allowed, saying that menopause or pain relief is all supposed to be allowed in their written policy. But what we've seen since is that, unfortunately, many people who were blocked before are blocked just as much, and some of them even more, since those policies have come out. So there is a written change to the policies, but in practice, algorithmically and in the technological implementation of these policies, we're still seeing a huge difference. So, you know, obviously the advertising policies for sexual health shouldn't be based on who you know or if your investor lives in Silicon Valley. But unfortunately, it's incredibly disparate, and we're seeing the disproportionate economic impacts on entrepreneurs in a very and on businesses and others in a really unfair way that stifles innovation.
You mentioned algorithmically, and I want to come back to that because I want to double click on that term. But before I do, one of the things that has always been so incredibly eye-opening to me is the differences in how I move through online spaces or in-person spaces and, say, my wife or others. And so one of the things that was surprising to me about this is I get annoyed because I get like those ads for ED like all the time. I'm just scrolling looking for a funny meme. Why are you trying to promote all these different pills? So what are some of the things that perhaps I'm getting ads for that people like my wife and others are not? What is that disconnect?
Great question. So in 2017, there were a couple of erectile dysfunction startups that were founded, and we started to see a mass increase in the amounts of erectile dysfunction ads and the types of ads. And very early on in those companies' lifespan, they were able to advertise on Facebook and Instagram. And similarly, it was, you know, an investor used to work at Facebook, helped make that possible for erectile dysfunction. And I think that erectile dysfunction should be allowed to advertise, but a lot of counterparts for people with vaginas is not. But some of the ED ads that are allowed say slogans like get hard or get your money back. Those are all allowed. There are ads with, you know, a short video of a bed banging against the wall for an erectile dysfunction company. So there are ads that definitely talk about pleasure and that you know, visually depict sexual pleasure for erectile dysfunction that is allowed. Interestingly, when Facebook added these about, you know, two-thirds of their adult product policy is new text that they added sometime last year. And one of the new pieces of wording that was added was that erectile dysfunction ads were allowed and premature ejaculation ads were allowed. That is in the same policy that Facebook says that pleasure ads are not allowed. So somehow they're just dismissing the fact that ED and premature ejaculation have to support men's sexual pleasure in the same policy that they're not allowing for the sexual pleasure of anyone who's not a cisgender man. But in addition to erectile dysfunction, which, like I said, I'm glad that ED advertisements have destigmatized that largely, you know, partly, and also have increased information about ED. I just want the playing field to be expanded. But also there are ads that are for ball hair manscaping. Those are allowed. They say, we save balls in some of the examples that we found. And a lot of these pictures of allowed ads are at the Center for Intimacy Justice Report, intimacyjustice.org/report, where we show those examples. And we really feel like, okay, if you're seeing examples of men's sexual health, then that sends the message that that health is important and valid. And it also normalizes and even destigmatizes things like erectile dysfunction. And people get cultured to realize, okay, you know, men's sexual health matters. It's normal, it's valid. And yet, the silencing of the sexuality of people with vulvas or other people, it really sends this message that it's not worthy of being talked about, or it's something that should continue to be silenced and not a source of agency or joy or expression.
You know, that's really fascinating. So I hadn't considered the normalization side of things. I think that's so powerful because you're right. I get frustrated by the ads. I don't particularly like ads, but in my mind, that's sort of, you know, normalized it, right? If I was having that problem, I won't have a problem reaching out to any one of these companies because I see it a few times a day. Mm-hmm. That's so so important. I never thought about that angle of it.
I remember meeting with somebody 8 years ago who had erectile dysfunction, and I'd never heard of it, or I'd never heard of people, you know, in their 20s experiencing that. And now I literally know the statistics of like 30% of men in their 30s, the investors in those companies are saying have it, and 40% in their 40s. And it's just become more of the mainstream information.
And I do think it's important that people know that that sort of disparity between men's health being talked about, being normalized, and women's health being less so is true in other places too. I don't take insurance in my practice partly because sexual health diagnoses are so rarely covered at all. But a man, if I have a male client who has a diagnosis of erectile dysfunction, which is in the DSM, that is a psychological health diagnosis, those claims will be reimbursed every time. And if I have a woman with orgasmic disorder, which is also in the DSM, I have yet to have that approved ever. It is really, really common for male sex therapy services to be covered and female sexual health and sex therapy services for the same issue to be turned down. So these are disparities that extend well beyond advertising, but in a way it kind of starts with advertising. Because if the people at the insurance companies that are deciding what drugs get approved and what diagnostic codes get covered are the ones that are like Wolf getting those ads funneled to them and having those experiences normalized, but they're never seeing anything in the real world about women's health and women's pleasure, why would they assume that those are things that need to be covered? Why would they think that those are issues that millions of women deal with?
Something makes me think about is how I read an article by Catherine Franke where she was a legal scholar saying, okay, feminist legal scholars have done a lot around a woman's right to say no to sex, but where are we, she says, on the right to say yes? In terms of, okay, these high percentages of women are experiencing sexual dysfunction, what are lawyers doing about that? She wrote this in the early 2000s, and it's very informative for our work a couple decades later. And one of the pieces of information she cites is that tort claims in law where a man will sue for injury for sexual dysfunction are used for men much, much, much more commonly than women saying, okay, you affected my sexual dysfunction, even though she doesn't say this in the article, but I would say that for so many people who've experienced sexual assault or violations, it has a huge impact on your sexual, it can impact your sexual life and of course be healed. But I thought that was interesting of how you saw it in law. And even in terms of movie ratings, I've heard that, you know, sexual intercourse tends to privilege men, but many women can't orgasm from it. But then things like oral sex, which are so beneficial for many women for the clitoral stimulation. I've heard that oral sex tends to make your ratings like something like R or X rated, whereas intercourse will only be like PG-13. So there's all these ways that we privilege men's sexual pleasure, and men's sexual pleasure is great, but so is women's and so is other people's. And the only other thing I'll say is there's a researcher named Sarah McClelland. She coined the term intimate. Oh, you know her?
I love her. I cite her in my own work and in my writing. She's based at the University of Michigan. I love her.
That's amazing. Oh, we'll have to talk about that. So she coined the term intimate justice, which of course has informed our work with Center for Intimacy Justice. And she found that women and men, and I think she looked at, she also had a like an economic lens, I think, in some of her work, but basically the women were having more painful sex, they were having fewer orgasms, all these objective measures of their sexual experiences were worse than men's. Where like for a man, a bad sex might be like, I'm not so attracted to my partner, whereas a woman would be experiencing extreme pain. And yet when she asked men and women, I think that the study only looked at men and women. I don't think it included non-binary or other genders. But when she asked how satisfied they were, that was the only metric that men and women actually reported similar rates. Women were equally satisfied for standards of worse sex, which meant that we had internalized having lower expectations. And I think that's so common and reflective when we see the orgasm gap that straight women face, but lesbian women largely don't, is we're just taught that our sexual pleasure doesn't matter as much. And that's really important to change. One way to do that is having narratives of women's sexual pleasure and agency in the information we're receiving, which of course, online platforms are largely censoring.
So, you know, in the spirit of Sarah McClellan, can you give our listeners who might not be sex academia nerds the way I am? I don't think I would. Well, if you're not a sex academia nerd, are you? Okay, so in the spirit of other people on this call who are not sex academia nerds, can you give like the elevator pitch version of what we mean when we're talking about intimate justice?
Yeah, my understanding, and I'm so curious to hear how you digest these two. You're probably the first person I've ever talked with who's read Sarah McClellan's research. But she coined the term intimate justice, and she talks about high level how political inequities seep into our intimate lives and seep into our sexual lives. So if you're having a power imbalance in other parts of life, we see a lot of those imbalances in power or what we're taught, you know, people are entitled to experience. We see that in our intimate lives. And I read her research when I was recovering from sexual assault and starting to just become much more sensitive to the disparate, the differences in how my sexuality was treated in my consensual relationships, where it often wasn't valued as much. So it really resonated to me that even in our consensual lives, there are these differences in what we're taught or deserving of. That's high level, some of the concepts. And I believe that she developed it because she started doing satisfaction research where people were reporting similar satisfaction for very different quality sex. And so then she started to look at, okay, well, what is actually going into satisfaction? What do people believe they deserve? But I'm curious your take as well about your takeaways from the research.
You know, I think you gave a great sort of elevator overview. The one thing that I've always appreciated is that she talks about how this gap impacts different populations. So she has written about, you know, the way we view aging adults and our elders as sexual creatures or not, and the way that informs our decision making around them. People with disabilities is a huge factor. Often when you know, McClellan's work comes up, we talk about intimate justice, and then my other favorite is pleasure equity. And I think both that ties into what you're talking about around these ED ads for you versus, you know, I can't even tell people I have a practice sort of things. That's an example of pleasure equity. It's not that everybody needs to have an equal number of orgasms across the board, but it's that everybody deserves to receive and to give pleasure. And the idea that pleasure is a right that people are entitled to, along with health and safety and those other things that we tend to think about, which has always been fascinating to me because it's in the Constitution. Life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And happiness and pleasure are synonyms. But the idea of pleasure equity and intimate justice, I think, are really key to a lot of what Wolf and I are trying to do, a lot of what I do in my practice. I use those frameworks. I do a talk on kink-affirming risk assessment and how to look at a client's, you know, potential for risk, potential for harm, which is one of our jobs as a clinician, but to not bring biases and stigma into it, not to assume that, you know, sexual or intimate behaviors that you don't enjoy are somehow problematic because they're not your thing. And we talk about intimate justice and pleasure equity, and we look at the ways in which people are influenced, not only clinically, but also for themselves. Do I deserve pleasure? Am I worthy of pleasure? Is what I have enough and I should just be happy with that? These are all really important questions that people wrestle with, and having a public space to do that, since we live so much of our lives online, I think is really important.
Yeah. I love hearing you say that. There's something so human and so valuable. I feel like sexuality is a place where you can experience such a span of human emotions. Like many of us have experienced, some of us experience trauma. And then yet, of course, there's so much love and joy and connection that can be shared. And so I really believe that pleasure equity is so important. And I know that there are other major challenges to solve. And sometimes I have a friend that works a lot doing support for rape survivors. And she's like, my, you know, all these women that are talking about pleasure, like it just doesn't matter in the places that I'm working with. And to that, I'm like, it's not that, it's just, we're all working on different pieces of the puzzle. And we can be advocating for pleasure at the same time that we're asserting the importance of equity in other lenses. But it's deeply personal, important, and it matters. It has to do with how we value how we value people and what we're all deserving of. And I think that joy is really important.
That ties back to the algorithms and the way in which content is served, right? Because so much of our worldview, just the human condition, is, you know, I like to say three biases in a trench coat trying to pretend to be an adult. And one of those biases, of course, is availability bias. And when I'm always getting messages about me and no one else is getting messages about them, yeah, it can be incredibly difficult to think about equality, to expect equality. I really hadn't considered it in that lens until we've had this conversation. But you're right. How do you even have the conversation about equality until you're seeing equality in the messages and the content in which we swim through every day? And Stephanie, you said something like, how many hours were people on Facebook?
Well, I looked at five different social media platforms. So you're asking me to remember Facebook specifically. I know Instagram was the most, but Facebook, I believe it was something like 7 hours a day people are spending on Facebook.
Yeah. So think about how that influences your worldview from the content that you serve to the ads you served. Oh, man. So incredibly important to take this on.
Yeah. I remember part of it, the information that's being blocked is largely for people with vulvas. Or women. And so it's information about their health that's being blocked. But also a lot of the information that's being blocked is by women or non-binary creators, where their stories, their experiences are being censored. And I remember getting into this work in 2017 when the Me Too movement was rising and thinking that if women could share more of our own narratives of our sexual agency and of joy, and also of increasing the bar beyond, you know, even above consent to be about pleasure, it just feel like it would change our culture so much for those narratives to be heard and for our voices around our own sexuality to be, you know, come to light and be able to share that truth through social media and through different types of information. And the other thing that I was thinking about when you were talking about the ways that with what you were just saying, and it also relates to what I was going to say what you were saying, Stephanie, about stigma around some of your work is when you were talking about, stigma because people have stigma against activities that they wouldn't be interested in engaging in. It reminded me, I came out in a business school class where I was talking about polyamory and I was talking about being in a consensually non-monogamous relationship. And responses I got were like, well, that would never work for me. And I'm like, that's irrelevant. You wouldn't really say that to somebody that was sharing about an identity that you had more sympathy around that's a different identity than yours. But there was this stigma around being poly. And interestingly, the night before we're recording this, which is so March 23rd, Somerville just passed the first anti-discrimination law in the U.S. for anti-discrimination based on relationship and family structure. But just another lens where certain people's experiences are seen as invalid or seen as stigmatized. And some poly dating apps, for example, can't be allowed to be on online too, or you still are limited. And an organization I know called Open here in San Francisco, led by Brett Chamberlain, did this campaign to try to make it so you could show not just one partner on Facebook, but you could be able to honor other people in your life. And the product was limiting it based on that. So many other kinds of sexual and relationship identities that get stifled by our technologies and cultural biases that are just seen as, you know, valid instead of seen as discrimination.
And that is a mental health issue. When people don't see themselves reflected positively, that causes harm to them. They internalize that as the only representation that they see is of their identities as something negative or harmful or dangerous or bad. And when they don't see themselves as at all, they tend to deal with a lot of isolation, a lot of loneliness, a lot of shame that isn't necessary because they do have community, they do have peers, they do have positive examples of whatever it is, whether it's surviving sexual assault or being polyamorous or being kinky or what have you. And yet we tend to only see the most harmful examples of any of these categories unless you're a dude. And I think that is so frustrating. I come out of the world of domestic violence, sexual assault. And one of the things that has been really difficult is watching women kind of adjust to, and I know we bring this up on every episode, and I apologize, guys, who are sick of it, but, you know, for adjusting to the world after the fall of Roe v. Wade. I was just reading research last night that they've seen a 10% increase in women's distress in the last year. Just general distress, general anxiety, depression, a decline in mental health over the last year. And a part of that is because all that people see right now are scary, negative, harmful, bad, prosecutorial, persecutorial sort of things. And the censorship of positive information about women's lives and women's health and women's pleasure and women's experiences, as well as non-binary folks and other like gender non-conforming people, could go a long way towards mitigating that. Sometimes the best way to help somebody is just to let them know they're not alone in whatever it is they're going through. And when ads and groups and products are censored, all that does is increase that sense of isolation that feeds directly into the mental health decline that we're seeing. Mm,
so profound. So interesting.
I want to get off my soapbox. Let me ask, tell us about Facebook. What did you do? What was the center's work there? How did you get the Meta agreement that you got? And how do you anticipate that playing out over time as they turn the ship?
A little bit of a timeline of the last 14 months or 15 months or so. Prior to 2022, people who worked in women's health or vaginal health or, you know, breast cancer health knew that across advertisers, information was consistently being blocked on Facebook or Meta. What Center for Intimacy Justice did and published in January 2022 is we consolidated data at the time from about 60 advertisers in that field, and we found and publicized the fact that 100% of the 60 organizations or companies, businesses, had had ads rejected by Facebook and Instagram. Every single one of them had an ad rejected, and 50% of them had at some point their Meta, whether it's Facebook or Instagram, accounts for advertising entirely suspended, where they might be blocked. They were blocked often for months at a time. So we put that information, we gave it to the New York Times, which released an article about this report that we publicized, which is on our intimacyjustice.org website. And we gave all these pictures of, you know, erectile dysfunction ads that were allowed, but an ad of a woman, for example, going for a jog to talk to your doctor about menopause, that kind of menopause ad was blocked, or an ad with information about how it takes 7 to 10 years to get an endometriosis diagnosis, that ad was blocked. So we released that report, and very quickly, within 2 weeks, a U.S. Senate Help Committee, where the team at that Senate office, Senator Patty Murray, their team read the report in the New York Times, and the Health Committee in the Senate wrote a public letter to Meta all on their own, questioning Mark Zuckerberg and questioning Meta, which Meta answered to Congress on. And then Hillary Clinton actually saw that the Senate had done that and tweeted at Senator Patty Murray in a back and forth exchange. We had some other state agencies take action last year. And then we saw, as we talked about before, that there were revisions to Meta's policy. And we had been really excited to see those revisions because we felt like we'd moved this mountain. You know, 5 years there hadn't been changes. And now there's, you know, like 160 words entirely new on the policy that allow more kinds of examples, including for vaginal health, that were allowed. Unfortunately, we're seeing that groups are just, you know, advertisers in this space and in sexual and reproductive health are being blocked just as much as before and having their ads and information rejected. So now a lot of our strategy in 2023 at Center for Intimacy Justice is figuring out how can we get government agencies that have enforcement action, so they have some regulatory power over Facebook, how can we get them to enforce change? Facebook, just from public pressure and even congressional public pressure, hasn't truly fix the problem, despite this being public information for 14 months. So now we're calling on the Federal Trade Commission, we're calling on state attorneys general, saying this is discrimination, but also this is unfair and deceptive advertising, which is what the FTC regulates. And it also violates, we're arguing, may violate consumer protection laws. So we're asking for those agencies to affect change and finding friends in government agencies and continuing to build the pressure. Our goal is that at the same time that we're working to change direct corporate tech policies and algorithms, we can also be sharing the story in ways that are also shifting sexuality through culture change. So, you know, by having conversations about Sarah McClellan's research or intimate justice or pleasure equity and showing women who are and non-binary entrepreneurs that who are fighting for, you know, the rights of female sexuality to be a source of joy and pleasure, that also we hope that people become more aware of inequities where it's not just that, oh, you can see, you know, Wolf can see an erectile dysfunction drug, but you can't, you know, a patient can't get reimbursed for orgasmic disorder who has a vulva. That might spark conversations about inequities in our pleasure, in our intimate lives that we hope can spark culture change that goes even beyond these algorithms. But this is a very clear example of how women's sexuality isn't valued in our technology. And it's a starting point for a lot of discussion.
So the tagging in of FTC makes a whole lot of sense to me. So if you think about Meta, right, that's Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp. Depending on how we slice and dice it, almost all the revenue, 97 to 98% of it, is through ads. Mm-hmm. And that ad network, of course, drives the product, but also, as we were talking about earlier, drives the reality for so many people in terms of how they experience the product and the platform, and of course, then shapes their views. Now, clearly, I mean, I don't think anyone, anyone would argue, oh, you know Mark, or you're on the same street as Sandy, no problem, you get an ad, but everyone else doesn't. I mean, clearly, that is not in keeping with the American way, that doesn't pass the fairness test. There's a lot of problems with that. But I wanted to talk more about the algorithm side of it. And, you know, specifically, I wanted to ask you, how do you define the algorithms that are driving a lot of this advertisement, and what has really changed? You know, Stephanie asked me a few episodes ago, she's like, well, what is a computer algorithm? Are they new? And I'm like, well, you know, they go back to the 1940s. They go back to the earliest computers with ENIAC. So what has really changed in the past decade to make these algorithms that are driving advertising and determining what content people can see so pernicious?
Well, there's so many ways. This goes beyond the Center for Intimacy Justice advertising work on sexual and reproductive health ads, but there's a lot of critiques about the ways that algorithms really reward posts and content that make us angry and very divisive content. And so that leads to people being on these websites longer when the ads are, you know, or engaging with the content when they're really frustrating. And many groups are arguing that, you know, where that's the work that they're doing, argue the ways that that has created a more divisive and polarized society. So there's so many impacts that the choices of what algorithms are rewarding and how that ties into business models are affecting society with the ways. So when a health advertiser submits their ad, there's some non-human computer decision that is calling out, okay, this in Facebook, they're being classified as adult products and services commonly, or sometimes as adult nudity, where the algorithm sees even something like a uterus, a medical image of a uterus on a website landing page for a menstrual health company, and it thinks, okay, that's nudity, which is against the policy. And or it will see a breastfeeding simulator that's being used in hospitals to teach people about lactation, and it'll be, okay, that's nudity, that's a breast. But it's not just nudity, it's also a lot of companies say that if they say the word vagina, and that would include saying vaginal dryness or vaginal microbiome, the algorithms will pick that up as sexual and just block it. And so a lot of posts that have to do with anything to do with vaginas or breast health, the algorithms are misclassifying as sexual. Anyway, that information is being blocked. And our position is, okay, we actually have very little visibility into what is happening with these algorithms with regard to this issue. Facebook has confidentiality. And so algorithms are largely a black box. They're not democratically available to the public or even to Congress in most cases, my understanding. But we, you know, there need to be improvements to the algorithms. But even if it's very difficult or to create that structural change, Facebook could still create a verification system where it can somehow verify that some company is a health company, where even if it might flag the algorithm with information that Facebook wants to not show, there's got to be some way of having some technological fix that you're not stunting an entire major segment of our economy and of our society. So perhaps if they can't fix it through an algorithm, they can find a verification process. But feel free to add your thoughts on the algorithmic issues. But there's just a lot of discrimination where an algorithm also might just, we know that like if it's trying to say if somebody should receive a longer sentence in, if algorithms are being used in like prison sentences, it can be very biased in ways that create racial discrimination, or the algorithms are learning information that's already has societal disparities. So then those disparities are furthered in discrimination and how the algorithms are enforced.
Yeah, that's a really good point, right? So these types of machine learning algorithms are only as good as the data they're trained on. And if they're already mm-hmm. trained on biased data, they're going to have biased results. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the FTC comes down tomorrow and says, fix it, what is Facebook going to do? They could retrain their algorithms, give them a whole bunch of ads that were previously prohibited and say these are allowed. I like your point about a verification system. You know, oftentimes we're relying so much on the machine that we forget that for years and years and years, the way we handled this was with moderation and, you know, intelligent people making intelligent decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've heard that Meta, in the case of, including CDC information, they can verify that it's the CDC and make sure that the CDC is able to blast information, even when there might be other sensitivities around COVID information. There's ways that they've done that before. They've a lot of smart people getting paid to work for them. There's got to be some way to allow women's health advertisements.
I agree.
It's not as hard as fixing democracy. This is a fixable problem if they choose to allocate the will to do it.
I mean, democracy's hard, right? Because you got to get everybody, or at least a majority of people, to agree. In this case, we just got to get through to a couple of boards. Mm-hmm. what happens next? What personal solutions exist for this? What can we be doing to, A, make sure more people know what we mean when we say pleasure, equity, and intimate justice? And B, what can people be doing to make sure that their digital lives and their online lives reflect the reality that they want to see in their day-to-day lives?
On the online parts, we're creating a collective movement where so many thousands of people's voices who care about equitable, fair information online, where we can have our voices be heard together. And so one way to get to make a difference is to participate and join the Center for Intimacy Justice Communications on our social media, Instagram, newsletter, on our website, because we share campaigns where people can sign petitions that go to Meta and that go to the FTC. And we share hashtags that people can post, where they can post about this issue, have conversations. We're always looking for people to bring attention, because really, we're building power collectively to say that this is something that needs to be addressed. So there are a lot of ways people can join this particular fight and be advocates on this issue. And then with regard to closing the pleasure gap, which I know you have so much care and passion about as well, hopefully, you know, this conversation about the disparities in ED ads or penis health ads being allowed, but not vaginal health, or ads about, you know, vaginal dryness or painful sex. Like, we want there to be more open conversations with our friends, with our loved ones. We want people to know that their well-being, their sexual agency, pleasure matter. I think that starting to be aware of concepts like Intimate Justice by Sarah McClelland can help us feel empowered to know that our sexual well-being and health and agency matter, and to in just courageous conversations in our own personal lives and our own intimate lives, which can be sometimes harder than a conversation in front of 300 people, honestly, like telling somebody that you love, can be scarier in some ways in a one-on-one setting. But I think that, you know, we're all deserving of equality in our intimate and our most personal lives. And that's one of the themes of intimate justice.
I mean, you and I are clearly on the same page here. I have decided that we are friends and we need to do more advocacy and outreach work together, because there are so many sexual health educators and coaches and therapists and people out there who dedicate our lives to making sure that people know that their lives and their bodies and their relationships and their experiences are normal. And it has been incredibly frustrating to watch the inconsistency and the unfairness and the overt ways in which people's experiences are just kind of quietly erased. And I'm so grateful that you are out there doing this work. And I'm so grateful that there are people who are able to get in front of Meta and able to get in front of Congress and to have these conversations, because it's something that you, it's very difficult to notice the absence of something, right? And until somebody points out the absence, nobody notices it. And I think that's what makes what you're doing so important, is that if nobody were pointing out these holes in our social media worlds, they would just very quietly pass us by, and a whole generation of young people would grow up not realizing how normal their lives and their experiences are.
Thank you for those words and for saying that. And it is so intergenerational. I just was talking with an entrepreneur in her 30s that talked about when she joined sex tech and sexual wellness as an entrepreneur, she was seeing the burnout of the generation before her. And my friend, you know, in her 30s was hoping that we would have had more change, but the changes are so intergenerational. And so the information that people can see in this generation affect, you know, in a very intergenerational way affect us. But I have so much compassion for your experience and so much gratitude for your work, where you're talking about this like grave discrimination and completely unfair practice that is affecting you so personally. And yet you seem to have a lot of health and overall well-being. And we need that for this work in terms of when we talk about it, to be able to still have the energy. But it's really terrible that this discrimination is so prevalent. And I'm so grateful that there are people who are educators and counselors and therapists like you that are continuing to persist and to collaborate and find ways to create change. So I'm grateful for your voice and for both of you.
So my role is to make sure she doesn't burn out. This is what I'm hearing. Well, with that, unfortunately, we're just about up on time. So, Jackie, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. You both are awesome. Agreed about being friends.
Thank you so much for tuning in to Securing Sexuality, your source for the information you need to protect yourself and your relationships.
Securing Sexuality is brought to you by the Bound Together Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit. From the bedroom of the cloud, we're here to help you navigate safe sex in a digital age.
Be sure to check out our website, securingsexuality.com, for links to more information about the topics we discussed here today, including the Center for Intimacy Justice. And check out our live conference coming in Detroit.
And join us again for more fascinating conversations about the intersection of sexuality and technology. Have a great week.